I had a little PowerPoint crash during the coffee break, but I'm back in business. A little reverse engineering, you get it all fed, you know. Okay. Yes. So there's my bumper sticker, competence without comprehension, that has the implication then that consciousness, understanding, mind is an effect, not the Ursprung, not the original cause of everything. So, as many people have noted, that Darwin explains the intelligent creator, or does Darwin explain away the intelligent creator? I would say the latter. But then Turing explains the godlike mind, or does Turing explain away the godlike mind? I view the resistance to Turing and artificial intelligence and the Turing test and all of that as a subspecies of the same anxiety, as a subspecies of Cartesian gravity, in effect, that there is a deep resistance to these strange inversions. And they seem to remove something wonderful from the world to many people. And my aim is to show you, no, they don't remove anything wonderful. They reestablish things that are wonderful. Nature is more wonderful now that we understand how it came to be than it ever seemed when it seemed to be the creation of a divine creator. It's spectacularly, inspiringly wonderful. And the same goes for the mind. The fact that if Turing is right, if we can build from Turing's ideas of computation all the way up to a res cogitans that can really understand, then how wonderful that will be, and we won't be stuck with a blank, mysterious pearl of specialness that defies explanation. We will have an account of our own ability to think and to explain and to play the game of reason giving that is such a hallmark of our intelligence. So I want to approach this by asking, why did Darwin and Turing have to discover these strange inversions? That is, why did they have to invert? Why were we so wrong for so long and so irresistibly convinced in this pre-Darwinian, pre-Turingian, if that's the way you would pronounce it, view? And in particular, how come? How come we got ourselves in the epistemological predicament that Darwin and Turing, in their different ways, get us out of? Now, this is, I think, a philosophical question. And when one encounters a philosophical question, this even raises the metaphilosophical question of what philosophy is. And I think this has been summed up best in an oft-quoted passage that I hope is familiar to you. If not, it soon will be. The aim of philosophy, abstractly formulated, is to understand how things, in the broadest possible sense of the term, hang together. In the broadest possible sense of the term. Now, those, of course, are the words of Wilfred Sellers. The inspiration, of course, for Pittsburgh, but a standalone figure of particular excellence, in my view. And this was in his opening passage of his classic paper, Philosophy and the Scientific Image of Man, where he distinguishes between the manifest and the scientific images. By the way, how many of you are already familiar with the distinction, the Salarzian distinction? Or how many of you are not familiar with it? Oh, everybody's on board already. Wonderful. But then I will simply be reminding you. But I want to make sure that you're all on the same page on this. So, how things hang together. Well, let's look at some of the things that have to hang together. And let's look at the manifest image first. Colors. People. Voices, an example of mine from long ago. Words. Dollars. Opportunities. Songs. Mistakes. I think you'll agree this is quite a variegated set of things. And if you just pause and ask, do they belong in the scientific image? Well, you know, there's human bodies, there's acoustic waves, there's ink trails, but all of these things, as familiar as they are problematic when you look at the scientific image. What's in the scientific image? Well, we have bacteria, DNA, atoms, electrons, quarks, who knows, strings. This is sort of getting from small to very, very, very small to mysterious yet, but who knows what's going to happen tomorrow. So if we look at the two images side by side in this way, we can recognize that a great deal of philosophical turmoil involves how you do just what Sellars says it's the job of philosophy to do, to say how they hang together. And this is a philosopher's job, because if you go to the scientists, you will find them often doing a really ham-fisted, inelegant, and largely misguided job. You can find many scientists who will say, there aren't any such thing as colors. Colors don't really exist. Nor, for that matter, do voices, or dollars, or words, or opportunities, or songs, or mistakes. None of that exists. It's only atoms in the void, or it's only electrons in space, or only waves, or only strings. And these impatient versions of eliminativism are often expressed by scientists and sometimes by philosophers. And scientists often express impatience and even incredulity with philosophers who say, not so fast. And then we get philosophers who make the opposite error of saying, oh, it's colors and people and voices and words and so on. Those are the real things, and the scientific so-called things are just figments of scientific fantasy. They're calculational devices. They're not the real things. The real things are the things of the manifest image. So I think Sellars has really focused very, very usefully on a whole family, not the whole of philosophy, but a whole family of perennial issues, and pointed out that this is a philosophical task. How to say what the relationship is between the things on the left and the things on the right. How things, in the broadest sense of the word, hang together. In the broadest sense of the word. Hang together does not mean identity. Identity theories are problematic. Eliminativism is problematic in either direction. So we have to look for other ways in which things can hang together, because they certainly do have to hang together in some sense, because we can see how much, among other things, predictive traffic goes back and forth across the divide. There is the science of color. Well, how can that be if colors aren't real? Well, a good question. But now what my question is not just how do these things hang together, but why is there a manifest image at all? Why does this philosophical problem impose itself on us? And why are the things in it so different from the things that science has discovered? Although I'm a great admirer of Sellars, I'm not enough of a Sellars scholar to say that he ever addressed this question, or if he did, had much to say about it. I don't think he did. And certainly his followers in Pittsburgh have significantly slighted these questions. Because what I want to say is that this is an evolutionary question, and no less philosophical for being evolutionary, that we need an explanation of how come there is a manifest image and what is it for? Two questions. And the short answer is, nature, evolution, took a brilliant shortcut, installing in us a practical perspective that works. And evolution honors things that work, even if they are less than perfect. As we say, good enough for government work. It misrepresents the world in a systematic way. And it took three great thinkers to undo the inversions: Darwin, Turing, and Hume, my third inverter. By the way, let me say, and in one sense apologize, my evening lecture tomorrow, my public lecture, will be about this very topic, and a lot of the slides that you've seen today, you will, if you come to that, you will see them tomorrow in a somewhat different order and compressed, but in other words, feel free to skip the public lecture if you've been attending these. On the other hand, it may, seeing them juxtaposed in a slightly different way may help if you really want to see what I'm up to. Let's talk about the user illusion, meaning by that the engineering term of software engineers who have benefited us all by creating the brilliant, intelligently designed illusion that we are, that is becoming second nature to us all. Click, drag, and drop folders and sound effects on the screens of our laptops and on our cell phones and other devices. The term user illusion is perfect because it's an illusion and it's for a user. And it is, as I say, intelligently designed, and it has been, the history of the design of the user illusion is itself quite interesting. I showed you the mouse as a recent invention, a part of the user illusion which may be on the way out to be superseded, not just by touch screens, but who knows what further investigations of the user illusion will soon be upon us. Let me stress the illusion part, which you probably know, but let me just remind you. It's not just that there aren't any little tan folders on your hard drive. You can't even find your files lined up in space on your hard drive where you might think. Everything is all scattered all over the place with pointers. The way the storage of information and files actually occurs on your computer is breathtakingly roundabout and hard to understand, and you don't want to bother with it. You don't want to know. You want to just think, I've got folders, and inside those folders are files, and I can click on them and move them places just like that, and maybe it'll make a little sound even, and I can drop them here and drop them in the trash. For instance, as you may well know, when you drop a file in the trash and then go to look for it in the directory and it's no longer there, all that has happened is that the first symbol of the file's name has been erased, making it invisible to the searcher. That's itself an oversimplification by a considerable amount. But that's why, you know, the file, all that information is still there unless you do a very, very careful job of erasing your disk. That's why people who think they've erased files that would be embarrassing learn that they haven't been erased after all, and that clever people who know the ways around behind the user illusion can recover all of those files because they're still in there. But you don't need to know that. The user illusion tells you you've erased it, and that's, for most purposes, what you want to know. I just want to stress how great the distance is between what's actually going on in the operating system and what seems to you to be going on as you move things around on your desktop and put them in the trash and recover them and click and drag and highlight and so forth. It's a brilliant simplification of a very complicated world. The manifest image is our user illusion, and it was designed not intelligently by software engineers, but the evolutionary way, by natural selection. And different species have different user illusions because they have different requirements. They're different kinds of users. The anteater, compare the anteater with the insectivorous bird. Insects are their chief diet. But their user illusions are profoundly different. The insectivorous bird tracks individual insects as they dart around trying to escape. The ant doesn't bother. The ant has a sticky tongue, the anteater has a sticky tongue, and the anteater just sees some ant the way we can see some milk or some sugar, and just laps it up. Ant is a mass term in the user illusion of the anteater, whereas it's a count noun in the user illusion of the insectivorous bird. We don't think of salt as, well, we can think of salt as grains of salt, or water as of drops of water, or molecules of water, but in our manifest image, water is water. It's homogeneous, continuous, liquid stuff. It's not made of water molecules. That's the scientific image. We have the the much of our manifest image we share with animals and with different animals, and some of it we don't share it with other animals. And then some of our manifest image is entirely a human benefit. And what I'll argue is that most of that is the result of cultural evolution, not genetic evolution. You've got to have culture to have that user illusion. But that's getting ahead of our story, because I now want to talk about David Hume. I can't resist putting this in. This is the famous portrait by Alan Ramsey of David Hume, and it hangs behind the desk of the president or rector of Edinburgh University, which is Hume's alma mater. And I got to see this when Edinburgh gave me an honorary degree a few years back. And looking at it closely, I decided that I just loved that hat. And I began to covet that hat. And I was back in Edinburgh a few months ago to give a lecture to the Edinburgh Philosophical Society. And I had a free morning. And I'd asked the students when I gave my lecture if any of them knew if there was a haberdasher, a milliner in Edinburgh that might be able to make me a Hume hat. And one fellow said, yes, there was, in fact. Down in Grass Markets, there's this amazing hat shop. And he took me there the next morning. And I took along on my cell phone the picture of Hume's hat and found a very fine shop. And the lady had, by wonderful luck, a bolt of antique velveteen of just the right color. And I now have my Hume hat. But that's not the end of the story. I asked the hat maker, do you have enough of this cloth to make some more? She said, well, yes, she did. So I've told the Student Philosophical Society has to fund its speakers and so forth. I said, why don't you become the middle person, so we're preparing an announcement, which I will tweet about in due course, and they will put it up on their website. You will be, if you too want a Hume hat, or if you have somebody that you need a Christmas present for who needs a Hume hat, you'll be able to order one through the Edinburgh Philosophical Society. So keep your eyes open in case that interests you. It's quite a good replica, I think. It's for special occasions, of course. You don't want to wear it every day. Okay. Now, Hume's strange inversion. Involves our experience of causation. Many things of Hume I just love. This is one of my favorites. And I will give you an oversimplified version, because this is not a lecture on Hume scholarship, but just hitting a high point. Hume says that our experience of causation is of not what we think it is. What we experience is succession, A's followed by B's in constant conjunction. And this, he says, causes in us a feeling of expectation. This is a forerunner of Pavlov, really. He has a little, and it's okay to have a causal theory of how we understand causation. He's, I think, right about that. It causes a feeling of expectation in us, which we misinterpret as an impression of causation caused by a perceptible property of the external world. Now, Hume, of course, has his impressions and his ideas, and impressions are the source, the cause of ideas. And he says We think we get an impression of causation from the outside world, and that's what causes our idea of causation. He says, no, it's actually an internal impression which causes, it's our anticipation of a B when we see an A that creates in us, that's the source of our idea of causation. In other words, the mistake we make is turning judgment and phenomenology inside out. We think we judge causation because in our phenomenology we experience causation. Now I am putting a sort of aggressive interpretation on Hume here. I say what Hume is really pointing out here is that rather than our judgment that A causes B being based on our experience in phenomenology of A causing B, it's the other way around. It's because we're judging that A causes B that we seem to have the experience of A causing B. Let me give you another example which will tie in with a lot of other philosophical works. I hadn't thought of bringing this up, but I think it will. This is the perfect context to raise it. One of my favorite anecdotes about Ned Block, who disagrees with me about qualia. And one of the psychological tests for laterality in the brain, left-right brain, is a test where, it's a visual test. There's also a test with hearing where you hear two different words, one in the left, one in the right, and which word do you hear? This is the visual version of that, where the subjects are looking straight ahead at a little fixation cross, and a word or non-word is either flashed in the left field or the right field. If it's flashed in the right field, that makes a strong impression in your left hemisphere, which is the language dominant hemisphere for most people, and vice versa. And what happens is that people are slower to respond and less accurate when words are flashed to the left of the fixation point than they are when the words are flashed to the right because of the crossover in the nervous system. You know, your left field goes to the right hemisphere, right field goes to the left hemisphere. So, sure enough, the way to test for laterality is to do this test. And what you discover is most people are lateralized to the left, that is, they find it easier to identify words and tell the difference between a word and a non-word when it's flashed on the right side than when it's flashed on the left side. Some people, left-handers in particular, like me, are less strongly lateralized, and there are even some people who are lateralized right for word identification, but that's pretty rare. So Ned had just been a subject just to see what it was like in such an experiment. And I said, well, Ned, are you strongly lateralized left? And he said, yes. And then he went on to say, in fact, my experience was that the words on the left seemed somehow sort of blurry. And I said, good, Ned, I want to know, did they seem blurry because you are having a hard time identifying them, or did you have a hard time identifying them because they seemed blurry? And he realized that he didn't know which of those two was right. Exactly, said I. You see, this is a case where it's a mistake to think that the phenomenal consciousness is the source of your access consciousness judgment. It's the other way around. access consciousness is the source of your phenomenal judgments of later. Now that may provoke some discussion later, but it is in fact an implication that I want to defend. So here's Hume's view. We see an A and a B and an A and a B and an A and a B. That's just succession. That's what you see. And it causes in you, eventually, the idea of an A causing a B, A causing a B, A causing a B. And it's all that you're given in stimulation is succession, but what you get from it is causation. If this weren't the case, animated cartoons wouldn't work. You wouldn't see Wile E. Coyote cutting the rope or landing with a splat. They'd have to have, in addition to a soundtrack, they'd have to have a cause track, which showed the causation. No. All they show is a succession of frames, and you see the causation just fine. It's a sort of illusion. The sound isn't actually coming from the landing of the coyote in the picture on the ground. It's coming from the soundtrack, but it sure seems like a causal relation. And an irresistible metaphor for this is that we project the feeling out and attach it to the object. We project the causation out. We seem to see causation right before our eyes, but this is an illusion, but it's a benign illusion. It's part of the human user illusion. I want to give you some other examples, because Hume talks about causation and how that's a benign illusion, and I want to point out a much more general point. I'm going to show you some examples. It would seem that we like honey because it's sweet. That's just about backwards. Honey is sweet because we like it. Let's look at a bad theory. First, there was sweetness. Then we evolved to like sweetness. Just wrong. Sweetness was born with the evolved wiring for liking it. If you wanted to get to the bottom of what sweetness was, and you decided, well, let's look at glucose. Let's look at it in, you know, real detail. Let's get down there and see if we can find the sweetness there. No. Theorizing about sweetness by looking very carefully at the structure of glucose is hopeless. You won't find it there. You'll only understand what sweetness is when you understand the class of sweetness appreciators. You need to study the brain and evolution to understand the existence of sweetness. Sweetness is a lovely property. But it depends on sweetness appreciators. So let's walk through the pre-inverted theory of sweetness. God sees that we should adore glucose because it's full of energy. So he sprays glucose with sweetness fog, which causes people to experience sweetness, which causes them to decide they love those sweet things with all the glucose in them. And that's how God made sugar sweet. No. There's one cause too many. We replace God with natural selection, which simply arranges for glucose to trigger a labeled desire, the sweet, yummy label in our brains, in effect. Now, that's crude for the whole story, which has been wired up to initiate, provoke, and intensify the getting behavior, and that's how we get our glucose. But what's part of that is the induced user illusion that the sweetness is in the honey, that that's that property that we love so much. And that's, in some sense, a benign user illusion. It's not that subjective sweetness causes the yum-yum reaction. It's that the yum-yum reaction creates the illusion of having been caused by subjective sweetness. And as Hume said about causation, we project the experience. There's an old joke. Two guys in a bar. One says to the other, "I think you've had enough. Your face is getting all blurry." This is the misprojection of properties out into the world. A similar misattribution. All right, I want to talk about phonemes. I'll talk about them more later when we're looking at the evolution of language. Phonemes are one of nature's greatest inventions. And I'm going to explain why by using a little example. First, I'm going to use not phonemes, but writing. So I want you to say what you see on the next slide as quick as you can. Now look closely, and you'll see that the H and the A are exactly the same shape. What have you done? That, by the way, is Oliver Selfridge's old example. Dear departed friend of mine, one of the fathers of AI, grandfather of AI, you might say. What you do is you normalize the shapes because you have an alphabet of categories that you automatically, involuntarily, without comprehension, normalize to. And only those shapes are the ones you normalize to. But now I want to point out that this trick, which is alphabet, which is a human invention to some degree, although it also is partly a culturally evolved invention, now I want to show you that it precedes human writing. So I want to do a little experiment with you. Some of you may have already encountered this. I hope this isn't an old hat to everybody. Are you ready? Listen carefully. I want you to repeat after me. Mundify the epigastrium. Again. Once more. Perfect. What does it mean? You don't have to know what it means to get it. You can just do it. Second case, are you ready? Listen carefully. And again? You can't do it. Why not? There was just as much acoustic energy, there was just as much variation, but you didn't have norms to correct it to. You didn't have an alphabet of norms that you could correct to. Phonemes, I say, are one of nature's great inventions. They permit the high fidelity copying of information without comprehension. Another great example is DNA. ACGT or an RNA ACGU, which is an earlier invention by nature of the same thing. Now, phonemes are, in one regard, one of nature's inventions, genetic inventions. You are born with the equipment to identify phonemes. But which phonemes you identify is due to cultural evolution, because languages have different phonemes. And you are equipped at birth to identify the phonemes of any natural language in the world. Babies raised, a baby of Spanish-speaking parents raised in China has no trouble learning the Chinese phonemes. The famous inability of, say, Japanese to identify, or Chinese to identify the L, R. I have to tell you a true story. I had a Chinese graduate student, my first graduate student from China back in the 80s, went to Endress Red Tape to get to America, came to work with me. And it turned out one of the things he wanted to do was write a biography of me in Chinese. And he proceeded to interview me with a tape recorder. And his English wasn't very good. But I started, and he wanted to know about my schooling. And I said, and then I went to Oxford, where I did my dissertation with Ryle. Who? I said, Ryle, Gilbert Ryle, the concept of mind. He said, ah, so. We call him liar. Which I wish I could have told to Gilbert. He had trouble with those phonemes because they weren't part of his native environment. Not part of his native, his natal environment. He could have learned them just fine as a baby. Both of these digitize information for higher fidelity transmission. The zero and one of computers is the same trick. It just has an alphabet of two instead of four or 26 or however many phones. This is the same brilliant engineering trick in all these cases that is something which permits high fidelity replication, which will resist erosion over copying. If you want to think about this very simply, you take a photocopier, a Xerox machine, put a piece of paper in it with some writing on it, press the button, and you get a copy. Put the original aside, put the copy in, and hit the button, and keep copying the copy. And pretty soon, noise will accumulate. The quality will go down pretty fast. On the other hand, if you take a computer file and send it to somebody, and they copy it, and then they send it to somebody else, and they copy it, and they send it around, like an MPEG or a JPEG, you don't get any accumulated noise because of the digitization of the file, the fact that it is a stream of zeros and ones. This is a brilliant way, discovered by nature first, and then rediscovered several times since then, of getting that high fidelity that, remember, is a requirement for natural selection. And so it's the invention of the phoneme that provides a key element for the invention of language, which provides a key element for cultural evolution, which provides the basis for much of what makes Gaudí-type minds possible. DNA is in the scientific image. Words are in the manifest image. And that's because the manifest image has among its features the user illusion of the phoneme. The phoneme is just as much an illusion as click and drag is. If you look at the acoustic signal, this is why speech recognition has taken 40 years and is still not very good in computer science, because it turns out that your ability effortlessly, almost, even though you're not all native English speakers, to follow my words, to see which words I'm speaking, has turned out to be a very hard problem in computer science, because the actual physical signal that's going in your ears is hugely more complicated than it sounds to you. Let me see. I'm just going to read some of this. Finds a good case. Okay. Both digitize information for higher fidelity transmission. The t of digitize, fidelity, transmission. The t, you hear those, that's the same. That's the phoneme. And it's the difference between time and dime. But in fact, those T's are all different acoustically. Physically, they're different. Being able to hear them all as the same is your phoneme system in action. And it is a wonderful blessing which can take, mundify the epigastrium. And it's all the same. You can hear the different accents. The acoustic signals are very different, but you normalize, you correct. It is the enabler, it is the key invention that makes language possible. And it does for culture, I'm claiming, pretty much what DNA does for evolution. It is the chief transmission means for cumulative cultural transmission invention. Yes, chimpanzees have some culture. Yes, whales, dolphins have some culture, but it doesn't accumulate the way human culture does. Only in one species does cumulative invention occur in us, and the chief reason is language. That's one time to stop, don't you think? I mean, what?
The meeting is 2:00.
Oh, we have. Well, why don't I go on? There's a bit more to this theme, so if I may, I'll just continue a bit, and then we'll have time for still some questions. Okay. In almost every case, there's a projection of a property. There's a Humean projection of a property that is properly internal or affective. We project those phonemes out. We could swear they're right out there in the signal. And yet, what 40 years of speech recognition research have shown by linguists and computationalists is, well, it's not. It's something that you construct on the inside. It's an action tendency. So Hume's strange inversion is that we misinterpret an inner reaction as an outer cause. Phoneme recognition is something which you need to look at the brain to see how it happens. We project it out into the manifest world. So what is this projection? Now, Hume doesn't use the word projection, although Hume scholars use it all the time. But Hume does say the mind spreads itself on the world. What on earth does that mean? We can recognize that it's the most natural metaphor given the view that he's putting forward. And it cannot be literal. It is a metaphor. Well, for what? What does it mean literally? It means that it's part of the user illusion. Let's look at one more example. Oh, this will be fun. We know what sexy is for, evolutionarily. What sexy is for, it rewards us for the time and effort spent mating. It's dirty work, but somebody's got to do it. There's nothing intrinsically sexy about these people, although it may seem that there is. If there were something intrinsically sexy about them, then how would God ever get chimps to mate? Well, one solution would be hallucination. But God didn't have to go that route. All you do is just wire up the chimps to like that look, and that makes the female chimp just as sexy to the male chimp as those young ladies are sexy to people like me. These are lovely properties. It stands to reason, we say, that we adore babies because they're cute. No, it's just backwards. We think it's because we find them cute that we want to cuddle them and care for them. But that's just about backwards. These are all strange inversions. And it was Darwin and Turing and Hume that have, you need all three really to explain them. These inversions all turn traditional causes into effects. So the manifest image, how did it arise? It arose by evolution, by natural selection. It's a brilliant set of misrepresentations. Back to Darwin and Turing, we have competence without comprehension. We have mind as the effect, not the cause. So we must launder out of our illusion, we must launder the illusion out of many of the things in the manifest image to properly understand it. And this inversion will start to dissipate the effect of Cartesian gravity. That's where I want to stop for today. Okay, time for questions. Anybody in the back first?
Yes, so for your argument against causation, what do you think about Lewis' view, who says that, well, any attempt may fail to define causality in terms of regularity, but instead it's much more plausible to define causation in terms of counterfactual dependence? I wonder, even given that what you said, if we accept that it's an illusion, why it turned out so practical and why in science, we find it a very valuable concept in that if we changed on C, then E would not have occurred. It seems to be what happens in science every day.
Yes, good.
And given that it's illusional, I mean,
yeah,
this practical value somehow it increases our faith in causality, right?
Yes, good. Very good. Very good. That's one of the huge oversimplifications of what I just had to say to get a point across. I think that a better view of causation is finally emerging in philosophy and science, and I take my ideas here from the work of Judea Pearl and Making Things Happen. Woodward, yeah, Jim Woodward. That, I think, is the proper prosthetic extension of Hume's ideas about causation. I think Hume is right about, as it were, the source of our idea, right only if you interpret him very aggressively, as I have done. He's getting at something important in the phylogenetic and ontogenetic explanation of why we have the idea of causation at all. But now that we have science, we've made some wonderful improvements. We've learned from R.A. Fisher how to use randomness to protect us from causal illusions, for instance. We know from Mill's method of differences, how you turn the knobs to see what's really causing what. Animals don't do that. But they have rough and ready good ideas about causation, which are being well explored now in experiments. But it's also true that they're not that good at causation, because they don't have to be. Competence without comprehension. Animals' understanding of causation is, even at the best, very rudimentary, but they have enough competence to detect and respond appropriately to a lot of the causes, as we would say, using our words and our perspective, in their world. Their manifest images are not as articulated as ours are, because they don't have language. And in a way, Hume is righter about animal notions of causation than about human notions of causation, because we've come along and elaborated on the basic experiences that we have of causation. Does that respond to your question?
Thank you. When you were using this metaphor about the files in the computer and the user illusion, I couldn't help but think, how do we know then that the other image, the scientific image, is not just something like an advanced user illusion? I was thinking of when you use a computer, for instance, you know that the files are a metaphor, something that it's not really there, as you said. But an advanced user will sometimes use, for example, the terminal to write directly.
I'm sorry, there. I'm having trouble with the... Maybe you're holding the microphone too close to your mouth.
Okay. Are you hearing me? Do you hear me now?
Better? Yes, I do.
Okay. So when you talked about the files in the computer and the user illusion, I was thinking, how do we know that the other image is not some kind of user illusion too, like an advanced user illusion? Because when you were talking about that, I thought of for example, the terminal that most software engineers use when they interact with the computer, which is a different interface, but it is an interface too, and in some sense is the same kind of device, a metaphor you used to. But I would say that I can imagine our theories, our scientific theories of the world being something like that, but I am not sure that I can think of them as being the equivalent of a direct interaction with the machine, in the sense that they seem to use the same kind of resources that our manifest image use. So I am not so sure about, I agree with the idea that we use some kind of interface, but I don't see how the scientific image would not be a very similar but more advanced kind of interface.
Yes, and let me use the very example to I think extend your point. It's a matter of some amusement to me that I know a lot of people who have degrees in electrical engineering who know nothing about electricity, and because they're software engineers. And software is their user illusion. And I have to tell an anecdote because Eric is here. Eric worked with George Smith very much, so did I. And George and I co-taught a course in Introduction to Computer Science. And I learned so much about computers from George, who knows so much about computers. And one day, this was back when the first IBM PCs were out, and I needed a memory expansion card to put in my PC. We only had a few of them for the whole program. So I got out my screwdriver and opened up the PC and found the slot and was putting the memory expansion in the slot when George came into my office. He said, What are you doing? And I said, I'm putting in this memory card. Oh! And I thought he was going to faint dead away. He didn't want to have anything. No, he'd never open a computer. That wasn't the level at which he was comfortable with computers. He's you can't imagine how well he understands computers, how deeply. I mean, he's my number one teacher about computers, but don't let me look at the hardware, you know. And of course we see this too in physicists, some theoretical physicists who don't let them in the lab, you know, they'll freak out, they'll break the equipment, they don't want to have anything to do with actual hands-on manipulation. They're theoreticians. So if your point is that the scientific image is itself a set of oversimplifications of sort of user illusions, I think I'm happy to countenance that and say the big difference is that they are intelligently designed user illusions, and they're hard to acquire, but they can be acquired. In fact, as we'll see later, one of the themes about of my stuff on cultural evolution will be how cultural evolution has itself evolved to become ever less Darwinian and ever more intelligent design. And so that a lot of the artifacts of cultural evolution today are themselves intelligently designed, well, that's obvious, isn't it? Intelligently designed artifacts. So we're living in the age of intelligent design.
Okay, so you would agree that the big difference is not that one of the interfaces is illusionary and the other one is absolutely real, but in the way they are made and the usefulness maybe of the different models.
Yes, and this of course handily reveals my pragmatist roots. I am comfortable resting there and don't have any obligation in my own mind to find a more ultimate reality than that.
I have a comment, a question, and a potential criticism.
Fire away.
The comment is that in your heroes list of Hume, Darwin, Turing, I would start with Spinoza, who I think invented in part the inversion trick. He does it for morality and he does it for final causes. So I think this will... I'll send you some quotes later today, and maybe we can talk about them.
Excellent.
It removes the English language bias from.
I am well aware of that and uncomfortable with it, but I'm just not the scholar to around it yet.
So my open-ended question is a kind of follow-up to the last exchange. I'd like to hear more about the, now between square quotes, the ontology of these free-floating rationales in the context of Daniel Dennett's official writings on this, namely the stuff about stats talk and the real pattern stuff. And I'm just curious how these free-floating rationales fit in the evolution of Dennett's thinking. The criticism, potential criticism, goes back to your example of the Lucas illusion, the what's the name of the machine, the Falcon? You had this beautiful Star Wars illustration.
Oh, yeah, the Millennial Falcon.
The Millennium Falcon. Yeah. So the Millennial Falcon has a function to entertain us and to give us a lot of great enjoyable moments. And it's become a meme and it's been...
Very successful.
Very successful. Now, in your description of it, you appeal to a kind of set of tacit distinctions that go something like a proper function and an apparent function, that go something like an intended function and a derived function. And it struck me that the tacit distinctions you are drawing on are all distinctions that Dennett has very artfully criticized over the years. And so I feel that there, you really don't have yet given us grounds for a distinction between a designoid and a
real designer.
Real designer. Because from the meme's perspective, the Millennial Falcon works just well as a useful cultural device, etc. Yeah. So I feel that there you are too concessive to Dawkins and in a way inauthentic to your true better self.
Oh.
So that's why I articulate it as an objection.
Okay.
You could do with it what you want.
Okay, good. Well, I look forward. I last read Spinoza carefully when I was a freshman. That's a confession, because for a number of years I taught the history of philosophy from Descartes. So I did read some Leibniz and some Spinoza, but I didn't really immerse myself. And I didn't, so I will be interested to see what you've got for me there. let's see, your second point was about the...
Oh,
yeah, right. And the yeah, yeah. Well, let's look at where I first used the term free-floating rationale. I think it was in the 1983 paper on intentional systems and cognitive ethology, where I used the example of the low-nesting bird, the piping plover that lures the predator away from the nest. And what I didn't really clarify there is something that has been sort of nagging me ever since. On the one hand, I wanted to say, look, the rationale is really there, but it isn't in the bird's little head. It's, unless it is, and that's what we explore empirically to see how much of the explanation is, as it were, an explanation about the the competence of the bird as a discriminator and recognizer and understander. Does it ever amount to understanding? And then I later talked a bit about the difference between having beliefs about beliefs and thinking about thinking, and suggesting that only people think about thinking. And I think that's roughly right, but I'm trying to develop that more. And in terms of real patterns, they're both real patterns. There's both the there's real patterns at several different levels or in several different inquiries, depending on the subject. Let me revert to one of my old examples I haven't talked about for years, one I've always admired. Interested in antique furniture, and also interested in fake antiques because I didn't want to buy a fake. So I read some books on how to detect fake antiques, which were also books on how to make fake antiques, because engineering and reverse engineering pull together here. Can't study one without studying the other. And one book I read had a very ingenious example of how to make a really winning fake, say of a 18th century card table. First, you make it as perfect as you can, using the right kind of wood and the right kind of varnish and the right kind of inlay and da-da-da-da-da-da. And then you age the inside the raw wood, the drawers, the way you do. You use ammonia, da-da-da-da. I won't go into all of that. But after you've done that, here came the sly bit. You take a modern electric drill and you drill a hole through it in some perplexing place that won't really mar it terribly. Why do you do that? You do that because it's the proof of the authenticity of the piece. How so? Well, because it's got to be there for a reason. Somebody's had this in their house, and they put a telephone wire or something through this hole, and no faker would ever do this. And so what the faker had very cleverly done is thought of a likely psychology, a train of thought that a buyer would actually entertain, but not in... I mean, this is just one of the trains of thought, and as I recall, the person who wrote this was quite prepared to concede that the person who saw the hole might not know why the hole, might not even realize that the hole was what convinced him of the authenticity of the piece. This was the rationale behind it. That's why this was a good thing to do, even if it wasn't the actual train of thought through the stream of consciousness of the buyer. I thought, that's really cool. I like the fact that this is explanatory and predictive. So I think that these are real patterns, and I think that the boundary between what's running through somebody's head in thinking and what is influencing them without ever being articulated as conscious thought, I think that's a permeable boundary, and that it is a feature, not a bug, of a theory which allows us to proceed without too much attention of which side of the boundary we're on. That's as best I can do at this moment about that. And your last point was about how the Millennium Falcon has a real function, as it were, which it's part of its fitness, which I think is right. But it also has fake functions. That is, there's designoid apparent functions which are in the service of a real function, which is the one you say, which that's fine with me. But there are such things as apparent functions that aren't functions. If you put what seems to be razor wire on top of your wall to deflect intruders from climbing over the wall, it isn't razor wire at all. It just looks like razor wire. It will have the function of deterring interlopers without having the function of actually being able to do what it seems to be able to do, namely cut people to ribbons if they try to cross it. And again, function, we have to be gradualists about these things. Function is, there's no, very important that there's no bright line between things that have functions that don't. And my favorite example of that is autumn foliage in New England. The trees, when the fall comes, the leaves turn all sorts of beautiful colors. And everybody rushes to say, that, of course, is a spandrel. That's not a real function. That's just a byproduct of the chemistry of the decomposition of the chlorophyll, and as that dissolves, it reveals the underlying chemistry of the leaf, which has reflects light differently, and that's all it is. No, that's all it was. But now, having brightly colored foliage is a fitness advantage in New England, because at foliage season, people come from miles around to see the foliage, and people don't cut down trees and even plant trees in order to show the foliage. So having beautiful foliage is now very much an adaptation. And that's, in fact, that's how all adaptations get their start. And the important thing is that there is no bell rings when something becomes an adaptation. It is, it's something which only emerges over time, and eventually it's obvious that it's an adaptation, and there's a period when it isn't obvious, and then there's a period when it's pretty obvious that it isn't. And it's the nature of evolutionary processes to traverse those gradual slopes without any moment at which functionality is there. And that's why we have to use a term like, well, it's useful, it's appropriate. It becomes more and more and more appropriate to use function language, or use purpose language, or use reason language. And the philosophical urge to define your terms and declare a necessary and sufficient condition is just misguided precision.
Let's see, my question is on the manifest image and on how we're supposed to think about it as an illusion. What sort of illusion is it? Is it that sort of illusion that vanishes once we're pointed out the illusion that it is? Or is it one of those illusions that persists despite being pointed out?
I think in most regards, it's extremely persistent. And notice that even the most committed physicist or microbiologist lives in the manifest image in the lab, not just at home. It's almost impossible to squint, as it were, in such a way that you don't conduct your behavior from the manifest image.
And yet this manifest image is pretty fluid, right? So you're willing to make it better, to replace it by our more elaborate.
In fact, I would go so far as to say that our manifest image is significantly different from the manifest image of several thousand years ago. Mm-hmm. Because it's been, you might say, contaminated, or you might say enriched by the scientific image. And we come to be able to see things quite directly that our ancestors couldn't see. Paul Churchland has some wonderful stuff about this in his book, his first book on scientific realism and the plasticity of mind. And he has this wonderful example. I actually wanted to use it here, and I was already abroad, and I didn't have my copy of his book, because I would have scanned the image from the book. The plane of the ecliptic. This is, you know, that all the planets' orbits are all pretty much in the same plane around the sun. And if you just look up at the night sky and you see Venus, you see Mars, that's Venus, that's Mars. But do you see the plane of the ecliptic? And he said, well, if you get a little tutelage, you can. And he gave this talk at Tufts many years ago. And it was, a starry winter night. And after the talk, we went outside and we stood in the middle of the tennis court there. And there were two planets visible, maybe three. He's really good on this stuff. Pointed them out. He said, now, just stand here and tip your head like this. And just think about where these orbits are and where the sun is behind you. And all of a sudden, click, you'll see the plane of the ecliptic. You can sort of connect the dots and see this. And it worked. And it was a stunning experience. And we all just, it was a lovely example of how a little scientific tutoring can enrich your manifest image. It became part of our manifest image right there and then. I actually talk about this example briefly in the first chapter of the book that this is all coming from, where I say, what I'm sort of trying to do is get you to see Cartesian gravity and come to recognize the various places where it tugs at our thinking and recognize it for what I'm claiming it is, a distorting force on our manifest image. So it's the same sort of trick I'm trying to do.
Thank you.
Do we have time? Yeah. Okay, so a straightforward question, no, you know, messing up here with comments and whatnot. About one of these strange inversions, the Hume one. So you said, and actually it sounds right to me, that it's not that we judge that A causes B because we have the phenomenology or we perceive A causing B, that it's rather the other way around, that we judge that A causes B, and that's why we have the phenomenology that we have. And you connected that to, you know, Ned's distinction between access and phenomenal consciousness. So let's assume you're right, you know, and that indeed that's a strange inversion that we should introduce in our, you know, thinking toolbox. There is another pretty standard way of understanding what phenomenology does for us vis-a-vis judgment. That is, well, you know, we form beliefs about whatever, not necessarily causation, but about the world based on what we perceive. And, you know, in some pretty straightforward epistemologies, that means that modulo defeaters, then if you perceive that Dan is sitting in front of me, then I'm justified in forming the belief that Dan is sitting in front of me. But if it turns out that that human inversion that you were sort of promoting here is here to stay, then what do we do with this other also strong conviction that, well, what we see, the phenomenology, is a pretty good justifier of what we believe or end up judging. So how do
mainly we... what we do with it is we throw it away.
But the idea that...
The traditional philosophical idea. And good riddance, you know, to simple sense datum theory, for instance. I would view all of this as impinging on arguments which have been around for generations in philosophy. You know, do you see the ellipse or do you see the penny sideways? And in fact, of course, it's very hard to see the ellipse. And if you think that you see the penny sideways because your phenomenology is of an elliptical shape in your phenomenological space, you're just wrong. Artists have to work very hard to see the ellipse. And when they do see the ellipse, it's not because they are scraping away the interpretation from the basic phenomenology. It's rather that they are using they're directing their attention in particular ways to create a very unusual phenomenology. And it's a mistake to think that that phenomenology is there all the time. Now, there's something, of course, that's driving your seeing of the penny sideways, which is going on in the brain, and which is taking that ellipsoid shape which is on your retina and going through some computational transformation which gives you the judgment of a penny sideways. But I submit it's a huge mistake to think that intervening in that process between the retina and the judgment, there is this phenomenal consciousness that is itself a theoretical illusion.
So we throw away those classic theories of justification?
Yeah.
All of them?
Well, we throw them away, but we do honor them and see how we can go and take the meat, the good stuff in them, and hang on to it. So what are they right about? They're right about the fact that the information that is available to the organism at the periphery is hugely ambiguous as a in determining what you
we end up judging.
What you judge. And that, well, let me remind you of the example that I had a lot of fun with in Consciousness Explained, of Shaky. Mm-hmm. Shaky, mm-hmm. the robot that can tell a box from a pyramid. And we can watch on the screen and see how Shaky does it. It takes the raw image and it turns it into a line diagram. It finds the edges and it draws and it uses line semantics. That's not the way we do it, but that's the way Shaky did it. And it identifies a box because there's a Y vertex in its line diagram. Now, that's how Shaky could tell a box from a pyramid. Well, what are these screens we're looking at? Shaky's not looking at those screens. Those are for us. But it is a brilliant way of understanding, from an engineering point of view, what the process is. I submit that we have to play exactly the same game when we treat traditional philosophical theories of perception and realize that these are engineering reconstructions for the benefit of explainers. And, you know, you look at Locke, the historical plane method, he says. I'm just looking and seeing. The hell he is. He's conjuring up a theory from what seemed to him to be first principles. It stands to reason, I must be doing this. He kids himself, he fools himself into thinking he's obtaining this by introspection. He's not. Any more than Block is obtaining his judgments about blurriness from the actual blurriness of his phenomenology. The blurriness of his phenomenology is a Humean projection from him, from his sense difficulty in identifying the words. So my sort of radical view is Block's got it exactly backwards. He has a pre-Humean and a pre-Darwinian theory of consciousness, in that he thinks phenomenal consciousness is this phenomenon that occurs in the brain, which is the source of access consciousness. And I think, no, you get all the way to access consciousness, and then that creates an illusion of phenomenal consciousness by a sort of Humean projection.
Thank you. Just a small follow-up question. In this last lecture, you talked all the time about the user illusion and sometimes about projections and misrepresentations. Yeah. But then, in a point, you said that sweetness and the like are lovely properties. So, do you feel some sort of tension here between illusions and lovely properties in talking about illusions all the time in this regard?
Well, the lovely property is that they cause the illusion. I mean, red is a lovely property. Then we, as it were, project it onto the surfaces of objects. That's part of a user illusion. Mm-hmm. But we do, and it's highly reliable. It's a projectable predicate of things. I think I must be missing what your point is.
My point is, yes, we project in a sense. I agree. In a sense, we project colors over on things, meaning, well, they have that, or this is a kind of thing that is out there. This color, colorfulness or something. But of course, you agree too that there's a real difference that we are tracking when we discriminate because of.
Yeah.
So this is why I feel a bit uncomfortable in saying illusions all the time.
Well, notice that in the user illusion on your computer, there's a real difference between you're putting it in one folder and another.
Yeah.
Those are real differences. All the actions you take on your desktop have real effects which are projectable and all. So there's, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that the word illusion has very bad public relations. It's considered a bad thing. And what the user illusion concept does is to begins to rehabilitate the word illusion and say, look, illusions, don't be so down on illusions. Illusions are very useful, some of them. Some of them are very bad, but some of them, the user illusion being a good example, are extremely elegant and wonderful parts of our world, parts of the manifest image. So they're real. I mean, yes, I feel the tension that you're talking about, and I view that as part of the tension that sustains Cartesian gravity. And I say, I acknowledge the tension and say, resist it. That is, don't succumb to it.
Okay. Today, tomorrow, another one.
Okay.